At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's an interesting fact about Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank. He got his PhD in economics at MIT, same place as it happens that Ben Bernanke did. As of today, though, they've got something else in common as well. Quantitative easing has come to the ECB. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 22nd of January today. 60 billion euros is the monthly nut for the European Central Bank, about $69 billion, maybe 70, plus or minus. In theory, the quantitative easing plan that Mario Draghi announced today is going to pump a whole lot more liquidity into the European economy, and with it, a reprieve, perhaps, from the imminent threat of a recession over there. That, of course, would be great for Europe, but come on, seriously? What's in it for us? Dan Bobkoff explains why we should care.
First of all, QE makes the euro cheaper and the dollar more expensive. That's great if you want to spend a weekend in Paris, but not so good if you export things to Europe.
Clearly it has an impact.
Rob Birch is CEO of Kindle Furniture in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Its stuff is really high-end, and some gets sent to Europe.
It makes our product, relatively speaking, more expensive than it was before if you're a European buyer.
This makes it harder for American businesses to compete. Then, think what happens when European tourists come to visit with less valuable euros in their pockets. They might spend less at restaurants or Saks Fifth Avenue when they visit New York. Europeans also love Florida. Paul Phipps is chief marketing officer of Visit Florida. He's not too worried, but says there could be some effect.
So instead of doing four trips, they may do three, but they're going to travel.
But quantitative easing in Europe can also be a good thing for the U.S., The ECB is about to print a lot of money.
It won't necessarily all end up in Europe.
Matthew Lynn is a MarketWatch columnist. He says European investors will take this newfound cash and do what they always do, look for safe havens and better yields.
And in lots of cases, that's going to be the U.S. because that's the fastest growing major economy in the world right now.
That could boost U.S. markets. And there's the big picture. Everyone benefits from a stronger Eurozone economy, says Kenneth Polcari of O'Neill Securities.
If it brings clarity and stability to the European market and it helps the Eurozone start to recover, that will be good for U.S.
He says even with a cheaper euro, with a little luck, Europeans would feel more flush and want to buy more of our stuff. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Those of you who had wireless service on their bingo card of Google's plans to take over the world, well, today is your day. The once upon a time just a search engine company is said to be getting into the wireless technology space. Google would effectively rent excess network capacity from Sprint and T-Mobile and then resell its own wireless plans to customers. But as with everything Google touches, it's going to change the market just by being in it. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
The wireless industry is already highly competitive, with carriers jockeying to provide cheaper plans and shorter contracts. So it might seem odd that Google would want to get into the game.
I think that they're looking at adding some other type of value beyond just a cheaper price.
Bill Menezes is with the research firm Gartner. He says Google will likely come up with some kind of wireless services plus package.
They have other things to offer, right? Whether it's YouTube-oriented or something related to Google Apps if you're a business.
In other words, he doubts Google will just use T-Mobile and Sprint's wireless networks and charge customers a few bucks less for similar packages. Sprint wouldn't comment on the rumored deal. T-Mobile pretty much said, go ask Google. Google is keeping mum. Bailing Yin at Stanford's Institute of Economic Policy Research says a move from Google could be disruptive to the industry. She could imagine Google trying to perfect a way of letting customers move seamlessly between wireless and Wi-Fi service.
The innovation here is going to be for them to discover ways in which they can provide ubiquitous access to ultimately what Google wants, which is Google's applications.
Yin says ultimately, Google may just want to learn more about being a carrier and experiment with ways to expand internet access in remote areas. What's in it for Sprint and T-Mobile? If Google pays to use their excess network capacity, that would help offset the costs they incurred for building up their wireless networks. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
One more quick thing before we move on. The dollar wars are over. Shareholders in Family Dollar stores approved a deal that would sell the company to Dollar Tree today. That scuppers a higher hostile offer from Dollar General, which is now completely, totally cleared to you, I know. On Wall Street today, I think today makes it four up days in a row in equities. I think. I don't know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Shares of Microsoft beat the overall rising tide on Wall Street today. Shares were up about 2.5% after the software maker's big new product announcement yesterday. Yes, Windows 10 is coming out, yada, 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 blah, blah, blah. The big thing was something called HoloLens, digital holographs, I guess, mixed in with the real world. Jesse Hempel is a senior staff writer at Wired Magazine. She has the February cover story. It's called Microsoft in the Age of Satya Nadella. Jesse, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Tell me what these things are like. You've had them on, or a prototype anyway, right?
This is a little bit like virtual reality, except nothing like it. Because it takes all of the best elements of virtual reality and layers them into the real world.
Explain that a little bit.
So essentially, the Microsoft HoloLens is augmented reality. It takes bits of the internet and layers them atop the real world. And so that means that while I'm wearing these glasses, I'll see the room around me, but I might also be able to reach out and draw a circle on the wall that looks like a real circle on the wall.
Give me the, when you were up there testing the prototype a number of months ago, give me the electrician example, because that was kind of a cool whiz-bang thing.
Okay, so first you need to understand I'm a creative writer. I am not an electrician.
Right.
But Microsoft put me in front of a set of wires that were just jutting out of a wall and told me to please fix the wall light switch.
Wow.
So I put on the HoloLens, and an electrician came up on a Skype screen. Kind of looks like a video chat.
Mm-hmm.
And the electrician was able to look through my goggles to see the wall, see exactly what I was seeing. And then he pointed to a tool, and in fact, he reached down and he circled it. And when he circled it, the circle appeared on the actual tool on my wall and told me to pick it up. And then he started drawing all of these arrows and very quickly directed me to fix the switch. It took 5 minutes, and I turned the light on.
He could see what you were doing, right?
Yes, he could see exactly what I was
seeing. So, you know, he could conceivably say, no, 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 not that one. Don't cut that wire. Right?
Yes, and in fact, he may have actually done that once or twice.
Do the compare and contrast for me with Google Glass, because that's the first place my mind went.
Right. Google Glass is to this product what minor league baseball might be to the major leagues.
That's fairly damning.
What my cousin's T-ball team might be to the major leagues.
Okay, that's even more damning.
Look, it's an early product. It, you know, Google Glass is old by now, and I think, you know, Google's essential decision to retool it is admission on,
right,
on the company's
right
part. It didn't work.
Which is coming out under, you know, Tony Fadell, who did Nest and all that whiz-bang stuff.
Exactly.
How much credit does Satya Nadella, the CEO, the new-ish CEO of Microsoft, get for HoloLens?
Funny you ask, because that is what our cover story is about in February. He did not seed this project. Mm-hmm. It was in the works when he took the role. But this is certainly the project that will define his tenure. And he gets a lot of credit because really the trick here is not the cool whiz-bang technology. Microsoft has always been great at that. They will continue to be great at that. The trick here is taking this product to market in a way that developers can work with Microsoft to build it out and customers will embrace it. And really, Satya has been working to lay the groundwork for that since he took this job by working better with outside stakeholders.
Mm. What's the niche or the niche, if you will, for this thing? Is it gamers? I mean, Microsoft owns Minecraft, right?
You got it.
So is it gamers or is it the rest of us trying to fix that light switch in the wall that you were working on?
So it's both, and that's a tricky proposition.
Yeah.
But if this device follows the path that most devices take, it will first appeal to consumers and probably to gamers. And that's why the Microsoft acquisition of Minecraft was so smart, because your 8-year-old is going to be asking you, please, yeah, for a holographic Minecraft.
Yeah. The answer, by the way, will be no, should my 7-year-old be listening. Jessie Hempel, she writes for Wired. Jessie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Years ago, the United Nations set a goal of stopping the spread of HIV by this year. We didn't quite make that, obviously, but Tim Fitzsimmons reports now on the costs and the benefits of the progress that has been made.
With 35 million people living with HIV and millions still suffering from AIDS, it can be hard to see how to bend the curve on the spread of this virus. But right here, in this office building off of North Capitol Street in Washington, D.C., is the District of Columbia Department of Health, which has successfully bent D.C.'s curve of new HIV infections in the right direction.
We had about 1,300 new cases at a peak in 2007, and we're just under 500 as our preliminary numbers for 2013.
That's Michael Carfin, head of the Health Department's HIV/AIDS office. He says the district's aggressive 3-pronged strategy of outreach, treatment, and prevention is the secret to its success. Outreach means finding and testing as many people as possible in schools, hospitals, and on street corners. Sometimes you have to opt out of a test. Treatment means getting those positive people onto HIV medications so they stay healthy.
And now, based on science, we know that people who are in treatment and achieve viral suppression actually are less likely to transmit, as much as by 96%.
Prevention means needle exchanges, safer sex ad campaigns, and the distribution of millions of free condoms. All this was achieved, Carfin says, with an annual budget of around $85 million. Another thing he says is the close relationship between D.C.'s government and its medical providers. 14 blocks across town is Whitman Walker Health. Its clientele has a large portion of LGBT and low-income people, two groups that bear a disproportionate burden of HIV infection. Richard Ellian, the clinical research director, says D.C.'s success shows that an aggressive strategy works up to a point.
You can show that over a 4-year period, you can reduce the incidence of HIV by 70%, and that you get really marked improvement. But that last 30% over time is not showing a decline. And that now is really where the illness is.
So the question now is, how do public health officials hit a shrinking target? Ellian says they have to get creative. Whitman Walker runs public health studies and surveys that look at the next generation of HIV/AIDS treatments, everything from new meds to cold hard cash, paying people a couple $100 a year if they stay undetectable and thus uninfectious. Compare that to around $20,000 in medication costs each year for every new infection.
If you look at other diseases, this same kind of falling off of success is common. And you look at diabetic control, same issues. The difference is that HIV, because it's an infectious disease, has ramifications.
Whitman Walker's surveys helped to show that a new prevention strategy known as PrEP, which involves taking HIV medication to prevent infection, works in the real world. Methods like these, known as biomedical interventions, should chip away at that shrinking target, says Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And as for those lofty Millennium Development Goals, he says it's okay to miss.
But when you set a goal and strive for it, although you may not reach precisely the goal that you set, it increases the energy, it increases the effort, and it increases, you know, the faith that you're going to get there.
The ultimate goal, Fauci says, is a world of HIV zero. No more AIDS deaths and no more HIV transmissions. Fauci and other scientists say that day probably won't come until we have a safe and effective vaccine. And that is at least a decade away. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I think the answer for the Academy is, okay, we need to actively invite more people of color and women and younger people.
Movies, but so much more as well. First, though, let's do the numbers. Traders celebrated the launch of quantitative easing over in Europe today, which, as we heard, will likely pump tons of cash into things over there. The Dow Industrial is up nearly 1.5%, 259 points, 17,813 is the number. The NASDAQ lifted more than 1.75%, 82 points, ended things at 4,750. The S&P 500 hiked 1.5%, 31 points, ended things at 2,063. Southwest Airlines more than 8% higher today after it said its fourth quarter profits were 71% higher than last year. American up 3.5% today. United Continental and Alaska Air jumped 4.5% apiece. Delta up 3%. Tech companies continued to tick higher, led once again by Netflix, which hiked more than 4.5% today. It's been a pretty good week for that company. Apple and Microsoft both rose 2.5% or so. Facebook, 1%. Yahoo lifted 1.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.8% on the nose. You are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for December. How many meals are Happy Meals? McDonald's releases quarterly earnings. And the American Pie Council says it's National Pie Day. Who is going to argue with that? Go pie! I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. From North Dakota, we have news of a record spill in the oil and gas business. Not a petroleum spill so much, but rather wastewater from the fracking process itself. And the way fracking is going these days, gangbusters, by the by. There is plenty of that wastewater. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has the story.
3 million gallons of wastewater spilled from a leaky pipe in North Dakota. State officials say it's the worst spill of its kind since the fracking boom began there. They say there's no immediate threat to human health, but Duke geochemist Avner Vengash knows what's in the water.
You have different types of natural occurring chemicals that, nonetheless, they could be toxic.
He sampled frack wastewater and found North Dakota's is 10 times saltier than the ocean that endangers aquatic life and trees. And it has ammonium and radioactive elements.
It could be this radioactivity will move from the water and eventually end up with fish and things that we consume. And
pipeline operator Midstream Summit found the leak this month and is cooperating with authorities. Fracking pumps huge amounts of water into wells, and even more comes back. A typical well can spit out 1,000 gallons a day. And law professor Hannah Weisman at Florida State thinks disposal is underregulated.
We could have, in some cases, plastic pipes carrying wastewater and leaking. And because the wells are, in some cases, remote, inspectors might not notice problems if a leak does occur.
Wastewater ends up in different places. It can be recycled back into the fracking process, stored in pits, sprinkled on roads for de-icing, even injected deep underground. But that correlates with earthquakes.
It's been a problem in Ohio, Oklahoma, Texas.
Wiseman thinks proper rules can address all this, likely state rules. This wastewater is excused from federal law on hazardous disposal. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The news from Europe today, that whole European Central Bank QE thing, has played out most prominently in the foreign exchange markets. The euro is at its lowest point against the dollar today in more than a decade. So if you've got even a touch of a travel itch, as Dan Bobkoff was alluding to up at the top of the broadcast, you might be thinking now is a good time to take that trip to Europe that you have been dreaming of. But before you go booking your hotel, take a minute, would you, to research airfares? Because as Marketplace's Noel King reports, your dollar will go further in Europe right now, yes, but you do still have to get there.
That strong dollar is certainly going to tempt many Americans to travel abroad. And airlines know how valuable their seats can become. So they're raising prices on flights from the U.S. to Europe, also to Asia and South America. That's according to George Hobica, the founder of AirfareWatchdog.com. But Hobica says there's a flip side.
Because the European economy is not doing very well and the euro is not doing very well, in order to stimulate demand, the airlines have lowered prices for Europeans flying outside of Europe.
Which is great for European travelers and bad news for those flying from the U.S. The airlines are also able to squeeze flyers for more cash because these days we're competing for seats.
The planes really are the fullest they've been since World War II, if you can believe it.
Barbara Peterson is an aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. She says there's a reason you may have noticed that many, if not most, of your flights are full or nearly full these days.
That is a product of the airlines having intentionally set out to cut the number of seats back when fuel prices were really high.
All of this sounds like it adds up to a bummer for budget-conscious travelers. But before you start sweating high-priced flights too much, Peterson says there are a handful of low-cost airlines that have emerged recently. She says over the past couple of years, airlines have grounded gas-guzzling jets with lots of seats. Now fuel prices are falling, and carriers may put some of those jets back in the air. More seats could mean lower prices. Maybe. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
This is an interesting time in the Hollywood movie video-based entertainment writ large world. Lots going on. So we called Wesley Morris, who writes about this stuff for Grantland, and asked if he was free to come into the studio and chat. He was, and here he is. Wesley, good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Three things I want to hit with you today, in no particular order. Oscars, American Sniper, and Amazon.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite? I'll let you decide.
I find American Sniper really fascinating. I find the whole, I mean, because there's so many levels to this story, right? And it does sort of meet up with the Oscars, obviously.
Right. So it's the debate over what the movie represents, the whole thing that's going on in society, where it's popular in this country, the South and the West. I mean, lots going on.
It's just totally fascinating. $90 million the first weekend, and like 105, I think, at this point.
So, have you seen it?
I've seen it.
And?
I don't like it.
No way. Come on, really? I just banged the desk, and you're never supposed to do that in radio. I am so looking forward to this movie.
You should see it.
Me?
Look, here's the thing. Bradley Cooper is 100% great in this movie.
But
he is. Well, it just, there are too many things the movie wants to try to do and doesn't do any of them particularly well.
Okay, fine. Maybe you didn't like the movie. What about
but that's separate from
what you have to figure Clint Eastwood, who directed the thing, was trying to make us do, which is using this movie to make us think about war in this society in this day and age.
I don't see. Here's the thing, though, for me, I feel like there's a second half of the movie that is only hinted at. I think that, the intent is to sort of complicate the automatic urge to turn a guy like Chris Kyle into a hero. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of leaving out,
because it is really complicated.
Right.
It's
morally complicated. It is even logistically complicated. And the thing the movie sets out to do, it just doesn't achieve, I think, in part because the script isn't that good.
You mentioned it. The Oscars.
Yes.
This rolls right into that.
Yes.
You and I were in this very room not all that long ago talking about the rise in black movies and how well African-Americans are doing. And oh my goodness, the award for Best Caucasian goes to.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully.
I stole that from the New York Post or the New York Daily News. I don't know who it was. But
hopefully,
right?
Bradley Cooper. I'll just throw that out.
All right. Well,
but here's the thing. I'm not comfortable with the pure racism narrative.
Okay.
And this sort of gets to my philosophical misgivings about what the Oscars have become from the standpoint of the studios and the media. These movies come out later and later in the year. Mm-hmm. And so Selma opened on Christmas Day. It went wide on January 9th.
Mm-hmm.
This is not really enough time to enter the sort of collective cultural consciousness. It gives people who feel like Selma was a possible Oscar frontrunner time to mount a campaign against it, which is effectively what happened with all the speculation about how Johnson is treated.
LBJ and all that.
In a movie that's really about something much larger than Lyndon Johnson.
The economic term here is recency bias, right? They're thinking that, you just saw this one 2 days ago, and now the nominations are out in a week and a half, and boom, there you go.
And the other takeaway, of course, is the racial issue. I think the answer for the Academy is, we need to actively invite more people of color and women and younger people.
And
there had been some movement toward that. Like, now they're releasing. There's always a story at some point in the year about, like, Seth Rogen is now an Academy member. Lupita Nyong'o has accepted her invitation to join the Academy.
I don't get those press releases.
You know what I mean? Like, it's cute. But right. that's a drop in the bucket given the infrastructural entertainment industry problems when it comes to these issues.
We are going to bail on number three because we are flush out of time. We'll talk about Amazon and
Studios. Yeah, we can talk about that anytime. Yeah, it's not going anywhere. And once they're going to go to Sundance and pick up a movie, so.
So we'll talk about it then.
We'll talk about it then.
Wesley Morris, he writes at Grantland. Thanks, man.
Sure.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, it turns out that the engine noise you might hear on the fine roads of the United States of America is often artificially enhanced. Fake engine noise, the Washington Post says, has become one of the auto industry's dirty little secrets. It turns out drivers do want better gas mileage, yes, but also the sound of a more powerful car. Volkswagen uses something called a sound actor, that's A-K-T-O-R in that way that they have. Porsche has a sound symposer, whatever that is. Anyway, we got some sound here. See if you can tell the difference. This is the real, actual sound of a Ford F-150. Here you go. All right, quick and dirty. Here is the sound, enhanced, if you will. I know, nothing, right? And I know it's tough to hear a car noise in a car while the car is going down the road, but trust me, it was no different. Probably cost you an extra $20,000, though. All right, we got to go. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor around here is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Oh, we should have just played that engine noise again.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.